Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 64. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Today, we're speaking about a very topical issue, working with displaced children and youth. Humanity is a story of movement. Long before we had terms like migrant, refugee, or internally displaced person, people have traveled from one location to another, looking to escape, trying to find something better, or even for adventure. The refugee situation that we are all currently facing is another appalling episode in a long history of displacement from war. And for every single person who is crossing a desert, a forest, or a sea, it is a unique disruption to their lives. Today, we're going to talk about children and youth who are refugees. What are the common and individual experiences these young people face, and how can we support them? Our guest is Adrienne Carter, a psychotherapist and educator. She has worked with Doctors Without Borders and Doctors Without Borders, MSF, and the Child and Youth Mental Health Center in Victoria, Canada. She has supported refugees and those who work with them in Kosovo, Sri Lanka, and Kashmir, among other locations. Adrienne has recently returned from Jordan, where she was training people in working with refugees. Welcome, Adrienne, and thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Wolfgang, for inviting me.
This is obviously a huge, huge topic, and we cannot possibly do justice to it in the very brief time that we'll be speaking. But I would like to begin the conversation today. Since many, many professionals who work with children and youth and families are seeing, and we're going to continue to see, an increase in refugees over the foreseeable future. So I would like to start with a little bit about you. You have a huge, a great deal of experience working with refugees. Can you tell us a little about your work with refugees?
Well, my work with refugees actually goes back a very long time. Maybe I should also mention that when I was a child, 12 years old, I myself was a refugee, and we have escaped from Hungary during the 1956 revolution. So as a young teenager, I experienced what it was meant to be a refugee. And in looking back, I learned a great deal from those experiences, because at that time there were no therapists who were ready to assist or really even knew what we were going through. So at a much later time, like about 16 years ago, I started working with MSF, Medicine Sans Frontières, in their mental health project. And I had about 15 different missions with MSF in different countries, where people were not necessarily refugees. They might have suffered from displacement during a natural disaster or a war, or oftentimes they, in fact, had to leave their country. Then in the last 3 years, I worked with the Center for Victims of Torture, whose headquarters are located in Minneapolis. And in Minneapolis, they work extensively with refugee clients, most of them who have been tortured. But they also work overseas, and I first worked in Kenya, where I was embedded with a human rights organization who were working with Kenyans who have been tortured in their own countries. There was a legal aspect, a medical aspect, and a mental health aspect. And then in the last 2.5 years, I had the opportunity to work in Jordan, also with CVT, where my job was to train local Jordanian counselors who worked with thousands of Syrian and Iraqi refugees. There were refugees from other countries too, but the largest number were Iraqi and Syrian. We worked with adults, with men, women. We also worked with a lot of teenagers. And as parents became more familiar with our methods, they started bringing their children who have been very, very traumatized. Many of them have been very traumatized. So we began a great deal of work with refugee children.
I'd like to go back just for a moment. You talked about working with MSF.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, most people think of MSF, and I certainly think of MSS, primarily concerned with, you know, physical support, medication, surgery, vaccinations, et cetera, et cetera. Why does MSF see mental health as relevant to their mandate?
Well, MSF has really started out as a medical mission. They were always the first ones to go into any country, whether it's disaster or war. But medicine goes only so far, and it's very much needed. I think I was involved in one of the first mental health missions in Kosovo, where the war has broken out. And at that time, there was very little guidance about how we set up a mental health project. So we were kind of, my colleague and I were kind of pioneers in this area. And we started to recruit a group of people, Kosovar people, mostly actually doctors. There were some nurses, there were teachers, there were school counselors, whom we have trained in the methods of providing mental health. And then they would go out into many of the villages that have suffered. At that time, the Kosovar people were just returning back home from being refugees in Macedonia and in Albania. And they found their homeland absolutely shattered. So it wasn't so much the medical needs that were really important. It was the mental health needs. What happens when people come back home and everything they worked for years has gone? Their homes were gone. Many of their family members were killed. So it needed mental health more than medicine. And that's, from that time on, it was realized increasingly more and more that whether it's a natural disaster or war, mental health becomes a very important part. And I just wanted to say a little bit, when I was in North Pakistan with MSF during the earthquake, initially the medical help was extremely important. The wounded were coming from all directions. But at the same time, after the wounds were treated, the mental health became very important because people lost family members. Several people became, the trauma has affected them so much that they became temporarily psychotic, and there was very little help because the entire infrastructure in northern Pakistan, this was back in 2005, has been broken down. So even to find one psychiatrist in the big city, it took a helicopter ride because all the roads have been destroyed. So there again, the same format has taken place. We found a group of people who were trained to provide some mental health support. And after the training, there was very close support and supervision of these counselors.
So you're working with, you know, adults, children, youth, anybody, everybody who's experienced trauma, regardless of the trauma, anywhere there's a need.
Yes, yes.
Would you say that there's a different, obviously there's different experiences, whether you've been tortured or there's been an earthquake or you're, you know, a new person to a country after traveling for 3 weeks. Is there a difference in how you work with people depending on the trauma that they've encountered?
Well, you know, this is a very good question, but I found whether I worked in a war-torn area, like with the Syrian refugees who have left Syria due to the war, versus a natural disaster, the issues were very similar. There were tremendous losses. There was many people became injured. Children lost part of their families. And the length, in a war, for example, the Syrian refugees have now suffered 4 years of war, constant war. Many of the children knew nothing else but war. A natural disaster is very fast, takes a couple of minutes usually, but the remnants of it stay on for a long time, and the losses are very, very strong. Now, it's sometimes more difficult in a war because people do that to other people, and your trust in people oftentimes is totally destroyed. In a natural disaster, it's more like the questions, how did God allow this to happen? So, both present a really serious spiritual crisis, whether it's a natural disaster or whether it's a man-made disaster. It's even worse in a man-made disaster. So we work with very similar issues in both. In torture, when people are tortured, there's a lot more body work also going on. But in any disaster, our bodies are very much affected. So we need to look at the mind, the spirit, the body. It's very much a holistic type of treatment that is provided.
How are people's bodies affected by trauma?
Oh, they're very much affected, because what happens so often is the trauma, you either flee or you freeze. And often when you freeze, that freezing remains in the body. So many times we find people who come, their bodies feel numb, they cannot feel it, or they have all kinds of aches and pains in their bodies. So oftentimes the first route that people take is going to the doctor saying, I have constant headaches, I have backaches, I have stomach aches, every single ache that you can think of. Well, unfortunately, what sometimes quite often happens is medication is given to stop the pain, but that medication isn't going to cure the pain. So the pain is caused because of the emotional experiences that they have had. And once we start processing those emotional experiences, their bodies slowly, gradually get better. In Jordan, for example, in addition to counseling, we also had physiotherapy. So every single client who came received both of this. So particular attention paid to the body as well as to the emotions, to the mental state, and to the spiritual state of the person. We had a lot of people who were quite suicidal when they came to us. Now, this is interesting because, of course, in Islam, like in other religions, suicide is not permitted. And many of our Jordanian counselors felt very ill at ease in asking this question because they felt that a good Muslim doesn't become suicidal. Well, many good Muslims, because of their experiences, have lost hope, and they were suicidal. So then it was a slow road in rebuilding those people so they can get a meaning in their life. They totally lost their meaning. For example, I worked with a young Syrian doctor who was in Jordan, and he was so badly off emotionally, and he became highly suicidal. He had big hopes back in Syria of, he already completed his medical degree, but he had to work in a hospital where they bought tortured people in, and he had to fix them up, but he was not allowed to provide any emotional support to them because they were watching him. This was back in Syria, and he would have gotten in trouble if he provided emotional support. So this was such a huge load in his psyche that everything that he has learned up to that time and experience became somehow nullified. He no longer knew who he was. So he kind of lost his identity, and he didn't want to live. So he needed some ongoing therapy, and it wasn't that long. It was maybe 5-6 sessions that he was able to start reclaiming his life and realize that, especially as a medical doctor, there is a lot of hope for him to start a new life.
Do you see the same manifestations of trauma around stomach aches and headaches and physical aches, as well as a loss of hope in young people? And you talked about adolescents in Jordan, and then eventually children as well.
Yes, we do. There have been many adolescents who came to us who have totally lost hope. And with the children, there were some additional problems, because although school was offered for children in Jordan, the schools became very overcrowded. I mean, imagine Jordan is a small country, and they now have about, I don't know the latest numbers, maybe 800,000 refugees coming into the country, which are huge numbers. So many children could not get into school. Many children, the parents were fearful of sending them to school. So they missed now a couple of years of schooling. That was one issue. Early marriages, many parents who were barely able to survive wanted their daughters to get married at a very early age. So by 15, 16, they tried to arrange marriages for them, because then hopefully their husbands would look after them, because the parents were often not able to look after them.
And were these marriages in the camps that they were in?
They were in the camps, or we worked primarily in Jordan with refugees who lived outside of the camps, what we call the urban refugees. And we had groups, for example, for adolescent boys and separate groups for adolescent girls. And many of the girls were talking about how, not necessarily their parents, but maybe their uncle said, it's time for you to get married. They would have been about maybe 15 years old. So they didn't go to school. They waited for a marriage to take place. So life became much more limited for these teenagers, much more than what it was like at home in Syria before the war.
And so how do you work with young people who have lost hope?
Well, this is what the therapy does. Once they start processing their pain, and once their bodies get better, they start to think about remaking life. We had therapy groups, for example. We had them for teenagers, we had them for children, we had them for adults, which was 10 sessions where they processed their trauma. But after processing their trauma, they start, the emphasis was on looking towards the future, what inner resources they have. Because when you feel so down, you don't even realize the strength that you are possessing. Yes, you can go ahead and remake life. And so with that, they started looking at life in a different way, that they're not going to be stuck in refugee camps or in such intense poverty all their lives. What are their hopes and dreams? Many of them have given up dreaming. And so trying to reclaim some of these hopes was really helpful. None of the people we had the opportunity to work with actually followed through on the suicide. But sometimes parents got so hopeless that they not only wanted to kill themselves, they wanted to kill their children because they couldn't face the future.
A lot of cultures around the world see counseling or therapy almost as a weakness, right? If I need help, I don't know enough about Syrian society to say one way or the other. Have you come across in the many different experiences you've had people who see counseling or therapy as a weakness or even going against their culture?
Well, it's a good question. In Syria, for example, I don't think counseling was very well known. Most of the time, because people live with extended families, when they have issues, they talk to their family members. And there is usually a wise grandmother or somebody that they can talk to, and they will get the assistance they need. And we also wondered about the same thing. Are people going to come? But when such trauma hits and they feel so bad, they gonna take a chance and see, okay, let's try out. What can these people do for me? And what was very interesting, when people started getting some relief from both their physical and their mental pain, they went back home and the family saw and the neighbors saw that they're feeling better. So they started coming to say, I want to get the same relief as my neighbor did. And within a very short time, we had people were just coming to our offices wanting help. So we had in Jordan, CBT had about 37 counselors. And we couldn't take them fast enough because we had a lot more people coming to us than we were able to handle it. So we started having wait lists. And then when the parents were beginning to get better, they bought their children. And we got a lot of small children of all ages, and they had all kinds of issues. Some stopped talking, others, anything you can imagine these children have experienced. And when we had children in a group and they started talking about what their experiences were, like 8-year-old children who from the roof of their house, they saw people being killed down below them and heads were rolling and body parts were rolling. Now imagine a little 8-year-old keeping it to themselves. She told her parent, but the parent couldn't cope with it. And so they just repressed this. But while they repressing it and they not talking about it, it comes out in all kinds of other symptoms. And the children then had a chance to express all this pain in words, in drawing, in playing. And it's really amazing that children who were so tortured by all these visions that they experienced, within a few sessions, they were relieved. I want to tell you of just a little story of a five-year-old that we had, where the child was totally non-functional. The child was in kindergarten but couldn't stay at all without the mother. We were told that the child was suicidal, constantly running in front of cars, didn't want to live anymore. And so he was brought to us for therapy. And the first session, the mother sat in, and we had a very skilled psychotherapist. Actually, it was an expressive therapist, one of my colleagues from Canada, who was invited to come for a week training. And she was able to hook this little boy within a couple of minutes with a puppet. And then the child, by the second session, was able to remain there without the mother and started playing all the war games, the good guys winning over the bad guys, and replayed it several times ongoingly, which is very normal for traumatized children. And by the fourth session, he was able to put away the war games and organized a tea party. So that meant to us that this little boy has been able to process the trauma he has seen, and his brother, his older brother, was also missing. And the mother was so depressed and really couldn't handle the pain of the child. So total change was reported at home and at school after maybe four sessions of therapy. This is just one example amongst many.
It's incredible to, you know, I've had play therapists on the program before, and it often it can seem from a distance almost unbelievable the transformation that can happen so quickly. You talked about your colleague being another Canadian, a trained psychotherapist. However, a lot of the people that you know you spoke about earlier in Kosovo, they were doctors, nurses, teachers, counselors. I mean, these are not people with, you know, master's degrees in play therapy or PhDs in psychology. In Canada, we would think of it as being unethical for, in many parts of the West, unethical for people to practice that level of intervention. What are your thoughts on that? Because you train people who are not necessarily experts in this field.
Well, you're absolutely right. The people that I trained all come voluntarily, and we screen them. They usually come from a different profession, and there are no counselors in most of the places where we are dropped into. So in Kosovo, I was myself very surprised that half of the group were medical doctors who wore their white coats for half the time, and the other half of the time they took off their white coats and became counselors. And they were able to learn many of the modalities that we are using. And while they did not do really in-depth therapy, but we did a lot of community work, like going into communities, doing a lot of psychoeducation, providing a lot of support to people who have been so hurt. And this has helped. It helps people to heal when they see that other people care and they want to help and they care what happens to you. I mean, oftentimes we just attended funerals of people or comforting the bereaved who had a funeral for their husband. In one instance, an entire village, all the men were killed, and all the older teens were killed. So the only male left in that village was a 12-year-old boy. Now, imagine this village that was just women and children. So we needed to provide some ongoing assistance to them. And it's not that each of them received in-depth therapy, but the kind of support this group of counselors were able to give was extremely important. We heard stories in Kosovo of the rape rooms where women were taken to be raped daily, and one of the doctors of the heads of the hospital was telling us this story of how it was so terribly upsetting to him to hear the screams coming out of these rape rooms, and he was traumatized by that. And just helping him to express this, to process it, to be understood, it doesn't really need a terribly experienced therapist, but it needs a caring, empathic person who can tune into that.
Yes, very well said.
In fact, I just want to add that my translator in Kosovo, who was a young teacher, and he did a wonderful job translating all the trainings, coming with us to all the villages. He has now received his master's in psychology degree, and he's now a psychologist.
Nice. That's wonderful. We've run out of time, and I my thinking is we've barely even begun our conversation, Adrienne.
Oh, there is so much more.
There's so much more. I fully intend to continue to have more conversations, hopefully with you and certainly with other people as well, around this topic, because I think it is crucial, and certainly we are seeing more and more in Canada, you know, that we have a new government who was just elected, and
yes,
they promised to have 25,000 new refugees by the end of this year. It's, as we speak, it's November 6th, and so they're talking 2 months, 25,000. And in the EU, they're just seeing waves of, you know, tens of thousands every day.
Yes.
In Jordan, with coming up to a million. I was in Jordan just when the Syrian war began, and it was already then, and that's 4 years ago. It was, mm-hmm, there was a lot of pressure already at that point in time. So I want to thank you very much. As we close up, is there anything else among the plethora of things that we could say? Is there anything else you want to say as we close this conversation?
Well, just maybe one thing. When you're talking about the refugees coming here in BC, in Victoria, we are really starting to prepare. We're in the process of organizing a refugee mental health center. And that's very unusual here, because mental health for adults, for example, is sparse, even for Canadian adults. And now what we want to start is providing therapy and support for refugees who are coming here. So we, at this point, there is no money, so it's a voluntary project, but we have already about 19 very experienced therapists who are ready to volunteer their services to provide this kind of therapy for incoming refugees. And we have provided the first training program, a 2.5 days training for people who want to work with refugees. And the plan is, once the refugees are coming and therapy is being provided, we are also going to provide ongoing support and supervision. So it's very much the same modality as has been really successful overseas, but replicating it here in Canada, in BC.
Yeah, and we have listeners all over the world, and many listeners from around the world will be experiencing or are experiencing that. And I really encourage anybody and everybody who is working with refugees or foresees themselves, not to forget the mental health piece, and that when someone comes and says they have a headache, there is often so much more than how it's physically manifesting itself. Not that we don't also treat the body, as you eloquently talked about, with a physiotherapist and counseling.
Well, the medical team and the mental health team and maybe physiotherapist, we need to work together as a team, because people who have been traumatized when they come, they need all of these services. And many refugees who came years ago have been traumatized, but never really had a chance to process their trauma. So this center will give the old refugees also an opportunity to come, because symptoms of PTSD don't usually go away by themselves. They can carry it for 20, 30 years, which we know a lot of people who have been carrying their symptoms. But once help is available, there is healing, there is treatment, and they will get better. So that's a very important thing to realize.
Yes, and I think that's the note to end on, that just as you said to those young adolescents and children you're working with, and children you're working with in Jordan, that there is hope, things will change. You don't need to see suicide as your only option, that things can evolve, things can change, and there is hope. Thank you for sharing. The hope comes through so strong in your own voice and your work and your passion, Adrian. I really want to thank you today for joining us and sharing some of your experiences and wisdoms.
You're very welcome.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast.
Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher.
Visit us online at cycpodcast.org.